Hello. You're about to listen to one of our audio-only webcasts, which was taken from one of our popular video webcasts. We'd love to get your feedback on how valuable and effective this format is for you. After you listen, please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio/survey to complete a quick evaluation. That's webcastaudio.com/survey. Thanks for the feedback and enjoy this podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to today's Microsoft webcast, Overview of the Regulatory Compliance Planning Guide for IT Managers. It's my pleasure to introduce today's presenters. We have Ross Carter and Bill Canning joining us. And without any further delay, I'm going to turn the session over to Ross.
Thank you, Tracy. Both Bill and I are from the Microsoft Solutions for Security and Compliance team. And today, as the agenda shows, we'll be first discussing some of the business drivers, both the challenges and opportunities of regulatory compliance. Then we'll be talking about some of the key regulations and standards that affect IT departments. Next, we'll talk about IT controls, probably more than you ever wanted to know, to be honest with you. And then we'll talk about the audit process. We'll get inside the mind of an IT auditor. And finally, we'll illuminate some of the key benefits of using a framework-based approach. And at the end, as Tracy mentioned, we'll open up the webcast to questions. As I mentioned before, there are both challenges and opportunities with regulatory compliance. I don't think anyone can argue with the statement that the complexity of the regulatory environment has definitely increased. This is essentially because both the number and breadth of regulations have also significantly increased. Another challenge is the difficulty of first achieving and second maintaining compliance. How do you achieve regulatory compliance when addressing multiple regulations at the same time? How do you maintain regulatory compliance in a cost-effective manner? Finally, and some might say most importantly, how do you avoid the consequences of non-compliance? For example, non-compliance with HIPAA, one of the regulations that we'll be talking about later on, calls for a $250,000 fine and even up to 10 years in jail. So now that we've hopefully piqued your interest about regulatory compliance by talking about some of the challenges, let's redirect our focus towards the opportunity. One example is using the obligation of regulatory compliance to justify automating inefficient manual processes. This is definitely a business opportunity. Another example of a business opportunity is competitive advantage. For example, for doing business in some European countries, you must be compliant with the European Union Data Protection Directive, EUDPD. We'll also be discussing this regulation later on. And finally, there's the business opportunity of the need for IT and business management to work closely together to solve the difficult task of regulatory compliance. So what actually is compliance anyway? Well, according to Merriam-Webster, compliance is the act or process of complying to a desire, demand, or proposal, or to coercion, and conformity in fulfilling official requirements. In the context of IT, compliance is a state of accordance with established standards, specifications, regulations, or laws. But realistically, it is whatever makes your auditors happy. And we'll be addressing the topic of making your auditors happy later in this presentation, because that's what it's all about. So to help you successfully navigate the waters of regulatory compliance, we have created the Regulatory Compliance Planning Guide. This guide includes background information about regulatory compliance, which we'll be covering today, In addition, this guide covers five key regulations mapped to a sample framework. And then the guide shows specific control areas mapped to Microsoft software and guidance. And yes, it's true, it's available today. If you want to check that link out, you can see the Regulatory Compliance Planning Guide in all its glory. Or non-glory. So,
glory.
Yeah, glory, definitely. Let's talk about the regulations and standards that are covered in this guide. First, there's what is more affectionately referred to as SOX, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. SOX pertains to publicly traded companies on the U.S. exchange. SOX was enacted because of various corporate scandals. No, I didn't say corporate scoundrels, but I'm sure there are probably a few of those involved in the scandals. Next, there's HIPAA, the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act. HIPAA is for companies in the U.S. healthcare industry and can also extend to other companies providing services to them. Then there's GLBA, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, also known as the Financial Services Modernization Act. This was essentially enacted to protect the privacy and security of private financial information collected by financial institutions. And we'll also talk a little bit about the EUDPD, the European Union Data Protection Directive, and associated national legislation. With the EUPD, it essentially provides baseline requirements that all EU member states must achieve through national regulations. And then last but not least, we'll be talking about ISO 17799. Although ISO 17799 is not a regulation per se, it does and can have the force and clout of a regulation. And this is essentially because other regulations recommend using it. So let's go ahead and move on to the next slide here. And we'll let Bill take over.
I was on mute. Unbelievable. Hi, my name is Bill Canning, and I appreciate you guys joining us today. Ross mentioned that we might cover IT controls in more detail than you ever wanted to know, but I think it's important because when you get right down to it, regulatory compliance, as Ross said, is what makes your auditors happy. And what makes your auditors happy are controls. They're really not concerned about performance. They're not concerned about functionality of your applications. They're not concerned about how happy your customers or your users are about using a particular system. They're really concerned about the controls around your IT organization and your IT systems. So let's turn back to Merriam-Webster and look at the definition for controls. A control, according to the dictionary, is a device or mechanism used to regulate or guide the operation of a machine, apparatus, or system. So basically, a control is something that keeps bad things from happening or detects when bad things happen so you can take some kind of corrective action. This is the world that auditors live in, and this is really the world of regulatory compliance. So let's look at controls. Let's see how the auditors kind of think about them. So when auditors talk about controls, they really talk about two major sorts of controls, as you see on this diagram. They have business controls that they think about, and they have IT controls. Now, business controls are the typical business processes that an organization uses to do whatever it is that that business does, or to buy inventory, to basically run the business. So these business controls are things like approval processes for a loan at a bank, or PO approval processes or sign-offs that are required, or receiving procedures for receiving inventory into the organization. Business controls generally are put in place to protect the financial assets or the other assets of the organization against misuse, fraud, accidental mistakes and what have you. So the business controls are usually something that the financial auditors are going to look at when they come in and do an audit. And it's a big part of, it's usually the biggest part of an audit is looking at the business controls, looking at the finances of the organization. For a compliance audit, there's a lot of, examining the business controls that occurs for that compliance audit. What we tend to be more interested in is IT people or the IT controls. And again, similar to the business controls, these are the types of things that keep the IT systems under control, operating correctly, and detecting when there are problems. You can further break down when an IT auditor comes in and does an audit. He or she tends to break down the IT controls into two general types. There are general controls and there are application controls. Let's talk about application controls first. Application controls are usually unique to each type of business, and they're generally the manifestation of a business control when that business control is kind of run through an IT system. So, for instance, most organizations have some kind of financial accounting system that keeps track of the books, keeps track of ordering, keeps track of sales, billing, et cetera, et cetera. When those business processes are automated, the manifestation of those business controls are application controls. So say I'm running SAP at my organization and I have processes that require a purchase order to be signed off by a manager when it approaches a certain level. So, anything over $50,000 has to be signed off by someone higher in the organization. When that is enforced by SAP, that is an application control. It's an IT control. It's run by the IT organization, but it's actually running a business process and controlling a business process. Those tend to be different at different organizations. So it's hard for, you'll have to understand what those are at your specific organization, to fully think about what's appropriate business controls, what are appropriate application controls. General controls are slightly different. General controls are the controls that don't relate to a specific application in an organization. These are things like change management, configuration management, availability management, identity management, sort of those basic processes that the IT organization has to do. And these all need to be under control too. Security is a big IT control. So these are general. They sort of form a base of control upon which you can build the applications, because quite honestly, having good IT security for your organization really doesn't buy you anything if you're not running applications or doing business on top of your IT system. So general controls are kind of a base. The application controls are built on top of those. But you need to have both sorts of controls to have an effective and under control IT organization. So that's a little bit of an overview. I hope it wasn't more than you ever wanted to know or too boring, but that's a start. Now, let's move on to the next slide here. Okay, so those are the types of controls. Now we're going to talk mostly about the general controls because, again, as I said, the application controls are often specific to any given organization. But these additional classifications of IT controls, they apply to both business, or rather to application controls and general controls. And let's talk about other ways to think about controls. And this is very important because this is how auditors come in and think about the different types of controls that are in place at your organization. One way that they break down controls is they contrast automated controls versus manual controls. They also look at controls as preventive versus detective. Let's talk about these two kind of ways of looking at controls. They're actually pretty obvious. Automated controls are controls that are enforced by an IT system without human intervention. whereas manual controls generally require a person to do something by hand or by running a process, maybe running a process that may be automated, but human has to be involved in some way. Obviously, automated controls are somewhat easier to rely on because they've removed the human factor and they just kind of run themselves. So an example of automated versus manual controls would be in, let's say I have a policy at my organization that says I need to have passwords of a certain length. So maybe I have a policy that says all passwords must be 8 characters or longer. That's a pretty common type of policy. An automated control would be if my IT systems where I choose a password are able to enforce that rule for me. And so if I try and select a password of less than 8 characters, it prevents me from doing so. On the other hand, a manual control would be if my systems didn't have that capability, and some don't, it's possible that I could put in place a manual control to try and enforce my policy, even though the system can't do it for me. So for instance, in this case, I might have to put a reminder, send a reminder out to the users of this system that they are required to have an 8-character password. It's going to require the user, the end user, the human, to actually do that, follow that policy. But it is a control. I've told users what they are supposed to do. I've told them the consequences of not doing it. Now I have to kind of rely on them actually adhering to the policy. So that would be a manual control, putting in place a policy that says you must do this when the automated system can't do it for you. Preventive versus detective. This is also fairly obvious. A preventive control prevents the bad thing from happening, whereas a detective control can detect when a bad thing happens and allow someone or some system to take some kind of corrective action. So, in the case of our password example that we've just been talking about, a preventive control would be something where I, again, try and stop you from creating a password that doesn't adhere to the 8-character password policy. So, again, like in the automated system that would prevent that, versus a detective control that would allow you to pick any length password, but after the fact I could go back through and run some kind of report or something that says, oh, well, this person, you know, these 6 people have passwords that don't adhere to the policy. If you put them on a continuum, as I've done at the bottom of the page, you'll see that for auditors, they generally tend to view more favorably an automated preventive control, and it seems rather obvious why that is the case. It's easier for them to rely on that control working, and you don't have to worry about the bad thing happening and clean up after the fact. So if I can put in place an automated preventive control for whatever it is, so for my password policy, I can rest assured that it's relatively difficult to circumvent that. As long as that automated process or automated tool is working, it's preventing me from doing something bad. On the other hand, a manual detective control not only can't prevent me from doing something bad, it also requires a human to get involved and remember, oh yeah, it's that time of the month where I have to, you know, run this report and make sure everyone's selected passwords are the right length. So you can see that there's a human factor in there that would be best if it could be eliminated, because then the auditors can come along and say, well, I see you have this good, effective, automated control, so that's good. Whereas for a manual detective control, you have to not only make sure that you have a control in place, you know, a policy or a procedure that says you'll do this thing, but you also have to prove that you actually are doing it, that someone actually is running that report and then following up on the people that have passwords that don't comply with the policy, et cetera, et cetera. So this is an opportunity for IT folks because, again, we want to put in place automated processes because it makes our lives easier. We would rather have automated preventive controls, I think, because, again, it's more cost effective. It helps leverage our time and effort as an IT as an IT person. So this is an opportunity where regulatory compliance requirements kind of line up with sort of IT best practices and IT sort of automation goals, and they kind of come together and give you a way that you can go to your management and say, look, not only is this going to have a benefit for us because it makes our jobs easier and makes us more effective and costs less in the long run, it also is better for compliance. So just an opportunity for you to kind of sell some of those automated processes that you may have been wanting to put in place. There may be some regulatory compliance impact there as well. Cumulative controls. This is one other thing that's fairly important to think about. When auditors come in and look at your organization, they understand that sometimes there is not one panacea control that you can put in place, or they understand that sometimes the best control is not available. Maybe the system doesn't support, you know, maybe one of the systems that you rely on doesn't support a capability that you need to put in place an automated preventive control. Maybe all you can do is put in a manual preventive control. That's the best you can do. In that case, they'll give credit, so to speak, for cumulative controls. So if you can't put in one really good control, sometimes it's almost as good or maybe even better if you put in two or three or four, you know, maybe less perfect controls, and kind of they have a cumulative effect that can meet the requirements that the auditors are looking for, meet the level of control that the auditors are looking for. So for instance, in a system where you can't put in place, where the system can't prevent people from picking short passwords, for instance, I may have to put in two controls to kind of achieve a similar level of goodness, of compliance goodness. So for instance, maybe I have a policy that says you must choose 8-character passwords. So that would be a really manual preventive control. I'm telling people to prevent, you know, I'm telling them not to do something. I'm telling them what they have to do, and I have to rely on them actually doing it. But then I could also have in place some kind of process that I run weekly or monthly that tells me when people aren't adhering to the policy. That would be a manual detective control. Okay, happens after the fact, detects when the bad thing happens, and then I can take some action. So those two controls together, you know, they may not be perfect, but they're better than no control or just one control. So, and again, sometimes the auditors will come to you and say, we don't think you have a good control for this risk. And you can say, well, okay, you're right, but we have, you know, two or three controls that maybe you didn't catch when we talked about when we went through the audit process. And, you know, we feel that these controls together kind of make up for that one weakness that we have, or where we, you know, we're not able to put in place the best possible control. So anyway, that's how auditors think about controls and what controls they kind of are thinking about. Let's move on here.
Thank you, Bill.
Yep.
Now that we're all experts on IT controls, let's talk a little bit about the actual audit process. So during the research phase for the Regulatory Compliance Planning Guide, we met with and interviewed many IT auditors, lawyers, and industry experts. And after condensing all this information that we've gathered, that's how we came up with the steps listed here. So essentially, we've summarized the general steps that are followed during an audit process. There was one specific interview that I thought was very interesting. So the auditor told me, he says, well, Ross, when the IT audit begins, it actually starts with lies. The IT manager says, welcome, and the auditor says, I'm happy to be here. So that's, I think, by gaining a better understanding of the actual audit process, the IT manager can help facilitate an early exit of the auditor. So essentially, let's be honest here, everybody, it's about being able to to get back to business as usual, at least as far as the IT manager is concerned. So, the actual audit process. First, during the actual the planning the audit phase, the auditor will require a list of all IT controls and supporting documentation from you. During the next step, the actual kickoff meeting, the auditors will identify which of the organization's resources will be required to support the audit process. Next, the auditor will ensure that the enumerated controls, the list that you provided to him or her, are actually in place and working. That would be step number three. And then you might be given the opportunity to remediate any found deficiencies. It's it will not necessarily happen every audit, but that might be a possible step right there. If you're given that step, then the auditor will then test any remediated controls. And if they've been fixed, it might even be possible to have them left off the final report. The next step, step number six, analyze and report findings. Essentially, a report is generated with a list of deficiencies, if any are found. And the deficiencies will fall under two main categories, design deficiencies and then operational deficiencies. An example of the design deficiency would be essentially if the auditor finds a complete or partial lack of controls for a given risk, or finds that the controls are not sufficient to adequately accomplish their goal. That would be a design deficiency. An operational deficiency, on the other hand, would be that the organization does not actually apply the controls as designed. Generally, you're given the opportunity to respond to findings. That would be step number seven. During this opportunity to respond to findings, you can list circumstances that might mitigate the findings. You can also list any plans that you might have to address any said deficiencies. And generally, most companies will try to address any deficiencies before the next audit. And then the final report is issued. The final report is provided to the IT management team. If there's a financial audit team on board at your company, they'll also receive a copy. Maybe even a copy is sent to the board of directors, and possibly sometimes the actual report will be sent to third-party companies, such as regulatory compliance-related agencies. So that's a little bit about the audit process. Our thought of including this within the guide was to give you as much help or ammunition to successfully survive an IT audit. So when you're working with your IT auditors, when it actually comes down to it, what do the auditors really want? Well, they want you to say what you're going to do. They want you to do what you said you were going to do and then prove that you did what you said you were going to do. And to assist with this, it's always nice to have an approval and workflow tracking system. And as Bill mentioned, that would fit into some of the automated IT controls. So how can you, IT managers, actually help improve the process? One, you can meet with the auditor early in the process to actually find out if there are any key areas that the auditor plans to focus on. You can also automate IT controls, as Bill waxed eloquently on earlier. And it also might be of assistance to you to better understand what is actually motivating the IT auditor. Know the IT auditor language, their lexicon. Know what they're talking about beforehand. And then you can impress them and show them, yes, we have automated controls, yes, we have this, and we are ready to go through this lovely IT audit process. And finally, use a framework-based approach to compliance. And Bill going to go ahead and talk about this right now.
All right. Thanks, Ross. I think for all those out there who've been through an audit, I think we can all agree. I know I've been through them. I've been on both sides. I've been the auditor and I've been the auditee. And the best thing that you can do with an auditor is get him or her in and out as quickly as possible, because it seems to generally be just a major disruption. It's something that it's kind of a necessary evil, but there are ways that you can actually get some benefit out of the audit. One of the things that you can do is, as Ross mentioned, that the audit report tends to go high up into the organization. Sometimes can land on the board of directors table. Will certainly be shared with IT management, and it is an opportunity for you to surface some issues that are that may be causing you problems, or opportunities, for automation, or opportunities for improving things in your IT organization. So that's fairly important. But oftentimes, it is kind of the best thing that you can do with an IT auditor is get him in, get him out, and get back to work. And one of the ways that you can do that is, as Ross mentioned, kind of organizing yourself in a way that works for the audit. Okay, and one of the ways that you can do that is by using a framework-based approach. Well, first, let me talk about how compliance has generally been approached recently, in the past, and then how we kind of recommend that you think about it differently in the future. When a new regulation comes along, I know I've worked in financial services, Gramm-Leach-Bliley came along, and we had to figure out, well, what do we do for Gramm-Leach-Bliley? It requires security, it requires privacy, et cetera, et cetera. We had to put a bunch of new things in place. We had to change the way we operated and ran our business, et cetera, et cetera. So we responded to that regulation. By looking at the regulation, having our lawyers and auditors and what have you tell us, well, here's what it really requires, then we went and implemented IT solutions and changes to our IT infrastructure, changes to our application to meet those requirements of Gramm-Leach-Bliley, and then we went about our business. Then SOX came along. We did the same thing. We talked to our lawyers, tried to figure out what it meant, what we needed to do. Talked to our auditors, we went through a bunch of things, we made the IT solution changes that needed to be made, and then we went about our business. And as each regulation comes along, you kind of run through the same process. Now, that process is, when a new regulation comes along, you're always going to have to do something similar. But we recommend that if you do use a framework to help kind of organize how you approach compliance, you can actually gain some additional benefit, and I will show you how that kind of looks a little different here. Now, what we recommend doing is, as I said, a little different than the approach that has been historically used in the past. So we recommend that you think about compliance through the filter, I guess, of a control framework. Now, first thing that we need to answer, the first question obviously is, well, what is a control framework? A control framework, quite simply, is just an organized list of IT controls that are appropriate for a typical organization. COBIT is a very well-known IT control framework. There are other frameworks out there that you can use to help organize your thinking, but it's basically just an organized kind of list of controls that are applicable to an IT organization, at least an IT control framework. There are control frameworks for outside the IT space that we're not going to talk about, but this is how auditors think. So when they come in, they almost always have a control framework in mind, and that's how they're making sure that they cover all the bases in their audit. They want to make sure they do a very structured, very rigorous approach to looking at your organization. They tend to use a control framework to make sure that they're hitting on all the parts that they should be hitting on. So because your auditors are using a control framework, it might behoove you to also use a control framework when you're thinking about regulatory compliance. Then you're thinking the same way as your auditors. You're talking the same language as your auditors. How does this work? How does it change how an IT organization operates? It doesn't change it that much. So when a new regulation comes along or when SOX comes along and you're using a control framework, what you do instead of saying, well, what IT changes do we need to make? What you actually start thinking about is how does SOX impact the controls in the control framework that we use. What controls does it require? What controls does it require to be stronger? What controls does it not necessarily impact? When Gramm-Leach-Bliley comes along, or ISO 17, or a European version of SOX or a Japanese version of SOX that people are talking about coming along. If that new regulation applies to you, then basically it's a process of looking at that regulation, understanding how it impacts the controls that are in the control framework that you're using, and then make that mapping. So now I know, okay, well, this is a new control that I wasn't required to worry about by the regulations that previously applied to my organization. Now I have to worry about this new control, et cetera, et cetera. So you think of the deltas. Okay, this new regulation drives new controls that I need to be worried about, or it drives additional, it requires that a control that I currently have in place be stronger than it is right now. So I can think about the deltas, and then I can address those deltas through changes to my IT environment or changes to my applications or whatever, changes to my processes. It's about the same amount of work up front, but where you get some value is when you come to auditing. Okay, so where you get the real value is I can now audit or evaluate or review how I'm addressing the control framework as a whole. And when I do that, I'm actually able to say, okay, well, I'm addressing all my regulations. So if I know all the controls that are important for the regulations that apply to my organization, and I can assess how well I'm addressing all those controls, then I can fairly easily say, okay, I'm addressing this regulation that applies to my organization and that regulation that applies to my organization. And this actually has a lot of value when your internal auditors can come around to your organization, come around to your IT organization and do a review. Because, as I said, they don't have to come in and do a SOX review or a HIPAA review or a Gramm-Leach-Bliley review. They can come in and do a control framework review and then have some feeling that you're in compliance with all the regulations at once. And that makes your job of dealing with the auditors less of a pain in the neck. So that's how a framework-based approach can benefit you. And actually, well, we have some words here about that. I think I've talked about all these things. So a framework can benefit your organization by making it easier to address new regulations. Again, it's not addressing so much, but it's dealing with them in an ongoing manner and also kind of evaluating how you're complying with all the regulations at once. It does use communication, though, between your IT department and the auditors. Again, if you're using the framework that they're using, you're thinking about the terms that they're using. And you're thinking about controls, which for many IT people is not something that they're, intimately familiar with. When most IT people think about controls, they think about security, because that's one of the few cases in IT where you're really worried about keeping bad things from happening. But, an auditor looks at your organization, your IT environment in a completely different manner. So kind of getting in tune with the control framework and getting in tune with the kind of ways that the auditors think about your IT environment helps make the audit go more smoothly, because your people are starting to think like little mini auditors as they're doing their job. Again, as I mentioned, you can audit for multiple regulations at once, which is generally a good thing because it, it requires less time and effort for the IT folks to deal with auditors coming in and doing what they do. And then it also allows you to prioritize your IT spending a bit. If you know that certain IT control is not adequate for the regulations that apply to your organization, so say you have determined, you know, I've looked at all my regulations, I've got my control framework, I've mapped the regulations into it, and I've done a sort of gap analysis, and I see, okay, I'm weak on these six control areas or these six controls. You can use the fact that three regulations require control A, whereas only one regulation requires control B. You can use that to kind of help prioritize where you're going to put your money first. So, you know, if you have a control that you can beef up that would help your compliance with three different regulations, that may be where you'd want to put your money prior to the control that only helps one regulation. So it does have a little benefit there. Let's talk about some of the frameworks that are available. This chart on the screen here shows a grid kind of similar to a Gartner sort of magic quadrant. You'll see across the bottom a breadth of coverage of IT. So when you look at that, if you're on the left side of that of the chart here, you have a more narrow focus on IT. Maybe only the framework that falls onto the left side of the chart may be not as comprehensive as the ones on the right side of the chart. Okay, whereas NIST, see NIST is kind of sitting in the middle, that is somewhat narrowly focused on information security, whereas COBIT is more broad. It's further over to the right and focuses on the whole spectrum of information technology and not just security. On the other axis, we have depth of coverage ranging from shallow to deep. Generally, the deeper the coverage, the more detail and the more specificity you're going to have in that particular control framework. So if you look at this chart, you see there's, you know, several control frameworks that are available. Some are broader than others, some are deeper than others. The one that kind of stands out to me is the one in the that's in the upper right corner, which is COBIT. And COBIT is a control framework that's been around for approximately 10 years, and it's on its fourth revision now, and it's generally considered the sort of de facto standard IT control framework as far as the auditors are concerned. So if you are thinking about organizing your compliance activities around a control framework, I would ask you to talk to your auditors, but find out what control framework they're using. You may find out that they are leveraging COBIT, and that might make you think that COBIT is certainly a way to go. If you decide to use a framework-based approach to regulatory compliance. Anyway, yes, COBIT is available. I'll just tell you it's available from the IT Governance Institute. If you want to check it out, you can download a copy of it. It's available at www.itgi.org, and just follow the directions. I think you do have to register, but you can download a copy of it. And it's worth taking a look at it because really what it is, they call them control objectives, so that's what what COBIT stands for, control objectives for IT. But really, they're kind of the things that an IT person or an IT organization needs to worry about, all the way from organizing themselves to having a strategy to managing their people, to managing their resources, their finances, their security, all those things, and all the way through auditing and making sure things are running effectively. So it's pretty useful even if you're not using it as a control framework, it's pretty useful just to kind of look at and make sure, are we doing all these things in our organization? Because they're kind of like best practice type things that you should be thinking about. If you look at, there are other regulations, or other rather control frameworks on here. ITIL is a big one that's more sort of an operational framework, so it's not quite as broad. It's more focused on running and optimizing your environment. You'll see COSO on here. COSO is generally more used on the for SOX type audits, and is often used by as an organizing framework for the financial side of the audit. We did include it here. Anyway, so let's talk about implementing controls in your organization. And this slide is maybe a little mistitled. It should probably be called addressing control requirements. So the way that you can use this control framework in your organization is, again, as I mentioned, you would start off by mapping the regulations that apply to your organization, and those could be governmental regulations such as the ones we're talking about. They could also be requirements that your organization puts on itself, so corporate policies could be mapped into the corporate control framework. And also there's regulations or requirements that may be put on you by an industry group. Many organizations have to comply with the payment card industry data security standards. And so they can all kind of be put into this control framework and kind of drive specific requirements. So now once I have my control framework and I know what my requirements are based on the regulations that apply to me, I can decide, okay, now how am I going to address these? You can look at each control and say, you know, am I doing a good enough job on this control? Do I have the appropriate controls in place to address this control objective? If you don't, then you probably need to take some action with respect to that control. And you'll probably, you know, as you're looking at your control framework and you understand the requirements or the control requirements for your organization, you'll see there's a number of controls that you probably need to beef up or address a little further. And you can look at the regulation that has the strictest interpretation of that control and use that as the one that you I'm sorry, I'm getting a little feedback in my headset here. So you can use that to drive how you want to address that particular control. Generally speaking, if you're going to address a control, you may want to think about addressing it once instead of addressing it at different levels for different, you know, I'm going to address this control this way over here and that way a different way over on a different system or a different part of my IT organization. It may be easier just to say, you know what, we're going to address it across the board, and we're going to address the most strict interpretation of the requirements for this control as we can. When you're looking at controls, and again, thinking with a bit of an auditor hat on, they're thinking about risk. Okay, they're looking at what are the risks to this organization. So you have to think about risk and use that risk as another way of prioritizing what you're going to address first. Obviously, the biggest risks are the ones that you should address first, and the biggest risks generally are the ones where you have the weakest controls. Again, as I mentioned, you can prioritize the investment in new controls where it can have the most impact, address it where they address the critical risks and where they address the most regulations. Okay, so that can help to prioritize, as I mentioned before. One caveat that I have to get in, you should always consult your legal counsel or auditors for advice in implementing specific controls. The regulatory compliance guide is a kind of useful tool, and it does help to understand how you can go about addressing the regulatory compliance requirements at your organization. However, it is not legal advice, so you should use it as such. One thing that I do want to stress, and we didn't really cover this, or very minimally covered this, the regulatory compliance planning guide kind of walks you through the process that we've talked about up to this point. It starts from the regulations. It gives an overview of some of the things we've talked about. It starts from certain regulations and actually maps those regulations into a sample control framework. It says, this regulation requires these types of controls. The next thing that it does, it says, well, if I need these types of controls, what kinds of technology solutions can I implement that will help me address those controls? And then finally, it says, well, if you need these kind of technologies, those technologies might be things like change management or document management or identity management or security. It then takes it to the next step and says, well, what does Microsoft have that they can help me improve or address these controls? What kinds of technologies does Microsoft have that can help me address my regulatory compliance requirements? And it's a pretty valuable resource because it does kind of provide an organized list of a lot of the stuff that Microsoft has out there. Many of the things that we have out there already can have a compliance impact. It's kind of a nice resource to be able to say, oh, yeah, I didn't even know that Microsoft had this guidance or had this capability. So it's probably worth downloading to take a look at, if nothing else. For that kind of, it may open your eyes to some of the things that Microsoft makes available to you that you may not be aware of already. So with that, I think I'm going to hand it back over to Ross.
Thank you, Bill. As Bill mentioned, that one chapter is titled Technology Solutions for Regulatory Compliance. The feedback that we received from our customers is that that's one of the key chapters that they really got a lot of information from. So. Please do take a look at that. So today, we're hoping that you now have a better understanding of regulatory compliance and how the Regulatory Compliance Planning Guide can help you in this specific environment. You should now know what compliance means. You should now have a broad understanding of what is included within the Regulatory Compliance Planning Guide. And also have an understanding of the regulations and standards that are covered within the Regulatory Compliance Planning Guide. You should have a better understanding of the different types of controls, as Bill talked about earlier, and have a better idea of what an actual IT auditor would be looking for when they come knocking on your door. And finally, the benefits of using a control framework and choosing and implementing specific controls, actually understanding those two concepts. So with that, we've also included a resources slide, and on this slide you can find related resources on the topic of regulatory compliance. And now I'd like to turn the time back over to Tracy, and she'll talk about the following slide for a bit.
Excellent. Thank you, Ross. Remember, for more information, you can print a PDF of today's session. To do that, just go to the File menu in your upper navigation bar. And now is a good time to go ahead and feel free to submit your questions now, because we will be getting into the questions and answers here shortly. Also, I'm going to be posting a survey here in just a minute. Please do take a moment to fill it out before you log off. We do appreciate your feedback. For any upcoming and previously recorded webcasts, you can go to Microsoft.com/webcasts. You can go here to access this webcast, which will be available on demand in about 24 hours. Also, if you have any webcast content ideas, if there's something out there you'd like to see and haven't yet, we would love to hear from you. And for anybody who's interested in getting a free 14-day trial of Microsoft Office Live Meeting, you want to go to Microsoft.com/presentlive. And here's a survey from our session today. Please follow the links provided to complete today's webcast evaluation. And Ross and Bill, doesn't look like we have any questions waiting in the queue at the moment. So what we can do is, if any questions do come through, we'll make sure to answer those through the text manager.
Okay.
And with that, I do want to extend a special thank you to both Ross and Bill for presenting today.
Can I jump in here?
You bet.
Okay. One thing that I would, since I have some folks out here obviously interested in regulatory compliance, my team is actually trying to gather customer pains around regulatory compliance to help us plan for further regulatory compliance related solutions. And maybe if I could take a minute to tell you what my group does. Microsoft Solutions for Security and Compliance creates guidance, kind of like the Regulatory Compliance Planning Guide, that address specific compliance or security related topics. And as part of our planning for upcoming projects, we would love to get feedback from our customers to understand what their biggest compliance pains are. So if you wouldn't mind and you have something that really bugs you about compliance and you'd like us to take a look at it and maybe try and put some guidance together to help address that pain, we'd love you to send a quick note to secwish@microsoft.com. That's S-E-C-W-I-S-H, secwish. And if you just put the subject line in there, regulatory compliance pains or something along those lines, and send that to us. Tell us what it is that bugs you about regulatory compliance, what you'd like to see us put out there to help you. We would really appreciate that input, and who knows, we may be coming out with guidance in the future that'll help you address that pain. So thank you. Just wanted to get that little plug in.
And this is Ross. One other thing, we'd also love to hear from you in regards to the actual regulatory compliance planning guide. Were we on target? Did we help you with understanding this space? What worked? What didn't work? We'd love to hear back from you. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Ross. All right, Tracy. Sorry about that.
No problem. Again, thanks, guys, for presenting today. I'd also like to thank the audience for attending today's Microsoft webcast. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's session. The audience may now disconnect from the audio portion of this presentation.
Hello, thank you for listening to this webcast. We value your feedback, so please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio.com/survey to complete a quick evaluation. Thank you.